know you're broken hearted, cause the piece you're
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to We Love No Other, a podcast from AlignItReport.com. I'm your host, Robert Rosenthal. My guest today is ESPN's John Gassaway. We talked, probably this time last year, I think, we talked about efficiency margin and your book that was coming out and everything else. So first, John, how are you doing?
I'm excellent. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, so let's start with the book. So I think it was coming out this time last year. So it came out, what, in March, was it?
Yeah, yeah.
So right. Let's start with that.
I think it was the Tuesday after Selection Sunday. That was a rush. That was a wild time. It's funny because, you know, we think, when we think in pandemic terms, or at least when I do, we think, oh, 2020. But having released a book in March 2021, I know the pandemic was still
right.
we were still waiting for the vaccine, I guess, is how I would put it. I didn't get my jab until the next month after that.
And book signings and all the normal
stuff. Yeah, you know, big splashy TV shows, which no doubt would have happened coast to coast.
I'm sure.
You know, all of that was virtual, which was fun. Uh-huh. I did spend a lot of time on Zoom various persons. So it was a particular kind of good time, and it also makes me look forward to the next one of those when I'm literally knocking on wood here, when perhaps we can do in-person things. But yeah, it's out there. Go get it. Miracles on the Hardwood. It was a lot of fun to do.
And then, you know, I guess is forgive me if I'm wrong. Gonzaga is a Catholic school, right?
That is correct.
Okay, yeah. So in a sense, 3 weeks after your book came out, there was almost another. It's about the history of Catholic schools, right? Like all of those, and then Gonzaga almost won the title.
Right? Yeah. Almost did it, almost went undefeated, you know, almost duplicated Indiana 76. So I was getting a lot of DMs all during the tournament saying, oh, are you going to come out with a, you know, second edition, which was a good question. If a Catholic team does something that no, you know, college basketball team has done in 45 years, that's a fair question. But Baylor had other thoughts right from the start of that game, and the rest is history. So it's still fairly timely.
Yeah. Yeah. So then I guess the last Catholic school winner would be Villanova, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then 16 and 18. Yeah.
And who before that filled that? You probably know all these after writing the book, but who were the, where does it go back from there?
Well, there was a long dry spell before that, and you got to go back to Villanova in 85. But they were preceded by Georgetown in 84, and then those two played in 85. So
that's right.
Here's the trivia for you. Baylor against Gonzaga last year. That was the first time two religiously affiliated institutions have played for the national title since 1985. So it was a wacky game on a couple of metrics. Yeah,
the Baptists versus the Catholics, basically.
Exactly. Yes. Very good. Yeah. Yes. Wow. Look at you pulling that knowledge.
Yes.
You're right. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And then I guess before that, what, Marquette was when? 77? I just went
77. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I had some friends here.
This is great.
No, yeah. I had some friends here the weekend of the. So I live in Champaign, and some friends who wanted to go to both games, Michigan Friday night, Purdue Monday morning. And so one of our breakfast conversations, or maybe it was a bar conversation, was let's try to name every title holder since, I think we started, for some reason we started with the NC State 73 team.
Whoa.
I think it was because, so I was born in 72, and one buddy who was here is born like 69, and the other one was born in 73. And so we just picked 72 and we tried to go. And it was this really weird exercise because by far the hardest decade was the 2010s for us. We got so
That's
lost with which
I thought you were going to say maybe the 90s. Okay. That's
interesting. It's just like the Duke UConn years of, you know, like which Duke? Wait, Kevin Ollie? Yeah, that's right, Kevin Ollie won. Okay, was that?
Yeah,
the,
you know,
it's just the, there were just some
century,
nameless teams.
You won't go wrong by just rotating Duke, North Carolina, and UConn.
So right,
they won their fair share. Yeah,
yeah.
Although I must issue a slight protest. It was actually NC State in 74. So.
Oh my gosh! See, there we go. Yes, I already screwed it up. Yes. So then who was 73? And if I've missed that, let's see. 73.
Well, that was part of a UCLA hegemony, but NC State, they were precluded from playing in the 73 tournament. David Thompson was just as great as ever. I believe they were even undefeated, one of the many undefeated teams not to win a national title, but they got their just desserts the next year in 74.
Well, there you go. Yeah, for whatever reason, just, you know, again, I'm growing up in the 80s, so I can picture everything about, you know, 85 Villanova, and I can even tell you the Keith Smart shot in 87 or whatever. You know, there's just, maybe it's childhood, maybe it's just what college basketball was, and it was stars and it was names. But I can remember all of those for whatever reason. You know, 2014, 2011, they just don't stick out to me. Like, say, you know, Danny and the Miracles or whatever, you know.
You were just too busy as an adult in 2010.
That's right. I actually went, it's funny, I went to, so some friends of mine will do a trip every now and then where we'll just pick a location. You know, I'm a football guy first, but I do love the tournament, and I am a college basketball game. So we picked Washington, D.C. to go to some tournament games in 2011. So we got to see basically the two teams who ended up in the title game, Butler and UConn, playing in that regional. It was the insane Butler game with Pitt.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which, you know, was just, you know, the guy fouled, getting a rebound on a free throw, trying to throw a full court shot, and just, you know, the insanity of that game. And then, you know, we got the first inkling that, you know, UConn could be this one man team to roll through everybody. So, it was just a really interesting kind of place to pick to go see games when, you know, you get to see both. You know, I couldn't have done that in the past because the regionals were actual regionals that were feeding into the next one. But now that they do the teams wherever they are, you can, you know, watch both title holders, you know, play on Saturday of eventual title participants playing on Saturday. So it was quite interesting.
Your spectatorship at that Butler game, it makes the memory even more prized. I was working for a website that nobody had heard of called Basketball Prospectus. Mm-hmm. And I had a piece out there called Why Butler Can Beat Pitt. And Pitt was number one seed, of course. Mm-hmm. And you were there, so you know how hopeless and comical that headline looked until the very, very, very last minute. Butler had absolutely no business winning that game. And then when there was a miracle and they did, everybody was like, oh, gas away.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, analytics. I'm like, yeah.
Analytics, yes.
Totally, yeah. Yes. Had it in the bag all the way. Yeah, yes. Analytics. Listen to me.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, it was, I mean, Butler almost lost in the first round. They need a layup. What was it? What was the guy's name? Matt Howard, right?
They were heartbreak kids all through there. Yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, it's just so weird how that, you know, Michigan State has four bad minutes against UCLA last year, or they would have just put them away, and then none of that UCLA happens, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just so crazy how, you know, what was it, Florida, when they were a 5 seed and they got that runner to go in to win in the second round, and then they just roll. It's just Tyus Edney, you know, just so many moments like that of like, it would have been completely over. And then after that little moment, everything rolled.
Well, the tournament is 67 game sevens, and that's the trade we make, is that absolutely anybody can lose. Not every team can win. We're not going to see a 16 seed win the national championship ever. But as we know, with devastating results in our neck of the woods, absolutely anybody can lose. And Virginia fans can tell you about 2018 sometime. I mean, literally any team can lose. So it makes for incredible TV, and we keep coming back. I love it.
I feel like this whole thing has been a big long setup to us having to talk about that game. We talked about Catholic schools, then we talked about the tournament, and we talked about anybody can lose. And we even touched on efficiency margins and why it's a little scary analytics-wise. So what was your thought going into Loyola last year? I mean, if we just use KenPom, you know, it was 10 versus 4 or whatever it was, you know. Were you, you know, as an Illinois grad, were you concerned about, you know, wow, this is an 8 seed, but they're a lot better than that?
Well, as a Illinois grad, I'm just, I am pre-wired to be petrified.
Yes.
I'm petrified. Okay. It's a continuous state of petrification. And, you know, I did write a book about, you know, this particular subject. I did. Just barely before the pandemic, I did have a sit-down interview with Sister Jean for the book, which made it all the worse because she really is, you know, A, incredible, B, very knowledgeable. And, you know, I was seeing all these Illini fans, you know, in the build-up to the game, you know, ooh, I hate Sister Jean, you know, mostly, you know, tongue-in-cheek, because
sure.
You can't really hate a 101-year-old woman.
Right. Right.
But I want to join in that good fun, and I couldn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
She really is amazing. And so yeah. That just added to my my reservations. And, you know, I'd been watching Loyola. I'd seen them look bad. I'd seen them almost lose at home, but I knew what their 50th percentile was. And, you know, give them credit. They played at their 90th percentile, and it was It was apparent. I don't have to tell Illinois fans this. It was apparent from the very opening minutes of that game. There was never any point where, you know, you felt, ah-ha-ha, you know, now, okay, little mid-major, look who came to play now. It's big bad boys. No, that moment, I kept waiting and waiting. It never came. Never came. So hats off to Loyola, and let's stay away from them in the bracket this time.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so let's talk, last time we did this, you gave your history with Basketball Prospectus, and that you and Ken were there, you know, you were kind of starting this thing, and that no one understood efficiency margin then. And, you know, I would say now it's, you know, you've probably seen it, that the awakening has happened, and, you know, even the casual college basketball fan understands it. But let's start with that. I thought maybe we could go through some of the crazy teams that are, like, you know, if we're just using KenPom's stats, in offense they're 3 and in defense they're 182 kind of thing. and if anybody can explain, you know, these splits and what makes a team like that and what styles show up when you're reading these stats, you know, it's probably you. So if you don't mind, and I'm sure you've made this explanation a dozen times, just for the casual fan, if you're trying to explain, you know, why you follow these statistics, why you were drawn to the, you know, you wrote that stuff, and you continue to write the, you know, advanced statistics stuff for ESPN. Just in general, what you're looking for when you're looking over the advanced statistics.
Well, the situation with me, and I know with Ken Pomeroy too, because we were emailing, you know, furiously back and forth back in the day before, you know, we were doing this profitably.
Sure.
Full time. We had real jobs. The situation for us was different because we couldn't go out there and get this stuff. We had to generate it ourselves. We were aided greatly. I was certainly. By a book, I think it was 2005, 2004, probably, Dean Oliver, Basketball on Paper, just an absolute brilliant guy, which gave me my push and my start, and I started whipping this stuff up in my own basketball kitchen, as it were, and it just made everything very clear. It was coincident to the 2005 Illinois team. And I knew that they were thrilling me and just dazzling me as a fan. And additionally, it was really interesting to sit down with this new pair of lenses and go, oh, okay, they absolutely never turn the ball over, and they make their shots, and that's a really good way to live. Okay, I get it. So it was valuable to me as a spectator of a sport I love, and I tried to share that in a blog I had at the time, and that led to the basketball prospectus thing. So that's kind of how that got started. And I kind of feel like, you know, even though this stuff is everywhere, as it has become better and better and more ubiquitous, I still find there's value in, you know, getting back to basics, doing the old time rock and roll, for lack of a better term, and saying, you know, no, Team X really is good because they play good defense. You know, we can generate amazing visuals and get into great detail, but at the bottom of it all is great defense, or something as basic as that. So I still continue to try and learn more all the time, and it's been a really enriching experience to have this stuff come about for basketball when it had been available for some other sports for so long.
Sure. So, like, I the team that gets talked about the most, and again, I know there's different efficiency margin. I'm just using Ken Pom's, you know, his adjusted, excuse me, his, you know, adjusted offense, adjusted defense kind of thing, because those have come, in my mind, pretty common with fans that are discussing some of these games of like, hey, look, you know, Iowa's defense is always blah, 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 and he can't coach this. And it gets generalized into, you know, look, Fran doesn't understand defense, and that's what, you know, all this kind of stuff. But I know there's more to it than just, you know, there's style to this, right? There was Dick Bennett basketball, and there's, you know, wide open Loyola Marymount basketball, and that's going to, you know, work its way into some of these. You know, some coaches care about this, some don't care about this. We're getting ready for the Minnesota game. You look up their rebounding numbers, and it's, they were, I think, 357th out of 358th on offensive rebounds. So you determine, look, Minnesota is a, as soon as the ball goes in the air, all five of you run back that way. If we make it, we make it. If we don't, we don't. And, you know, not giving up transition and setting the defense is the key to how we're going to play basketball. So I just kind of wanted to talk in generalities of when you're looking at some of these numbers and style, how you see it. And maybe we can use Iowa, because the Fran's style is always really solid offense and has really never been that solid of defense. And I just am curious how you view something like that.
Yeah, Iowa has been, you know, more than solid on offense. They've been outstanding on offense throughout the Luka Garza era. And, you know, who knew that a new era was dawning after that
right.
one. The Keegan Murray era looks like it'll be every bit as promising on offense. And, you know, Fran and Iowa take a lot of grief for their defense. I am equipped to defend, no pun intended, a team in that situation. It's kind of what people said about the Lonzo Ball UCLA team a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because statistically, you know, people go to KenPom and
yep.
they look at the number, you know, defensive efficiency. It's a big number. Oh, and no team with a number, you know, worse than blank has ever won the national championship. And not that people are even talking about national championship hopes for Iowa, but just in the context of great offense, not much defense, it's important not to care too much how a team gets the job done. And if a team is managing to outscore opponents by a really big margin, and their defense isn't that good, our reaction, in addition to your defense isn't that good, should be, my gosh, how great is your offense,
right.
If you're
right.
If you're able to do this with this defense.
Yes.
And we have seen, you know, teams that can play that way. To draw an Illinois parallel from way back, the 2005 team, their defense was statistically very good. And I always felt like that team got a benefit just from ripping the hearts out of opponents and outscoring them and getting, you know, just removing their will to compete. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying, you know, that's the case with a garden variety Iowa team, but I make allowances for an offense that good. I can imagine an offense that efficient happening. And then the last thing that I have to point out, just to be fair to all of the many Hawkeye fans ducking in on the call here, I was actually been, you know, fine on defense in Big Ten play so far. If you're talking about bad defenses, mm-hmm. we can point a lot of fingers, starting with some very surprising directions up to and including Michigan State. I realize it's early in Big Ten play as we record this, but we might have to get a mea culpa out to Iowa City, because the early returns, you know, they're not great, but they're more normal looking than they have been in a while from Iowa. So we'll see what they can put together.
So when you look at, I'm trying to maybe pick your brain as to how you view basketball. How much do you watch for style? Do you have a favorite? You know, like I mentioned, you know, well, let's just use Underwood. You know, he had this high pressure defense kind of thing that was going to be his thing. You know, you build your shot volume because you're turning them over 22 times a game, and you're, you know, you're doing this, and so what? You're going to give up some of those back doors, but you make up for it in other ways and kind of thing. Do you have a style that, you know, you're thinking, okay, it's the game in 2022, and this is what, you know, what should be? And I know it depends on the roster, and you've got, you know, when Underwood had Juwan Evans at Oklahoma State, he's just, well, this is going to be our offense because we have this. But do you look in terms of advanced statistics and basketball style and say, look, you know, Dick Bennett wouldn't work anymore or whatever kind of thing? Do you look at it like that?
Well, I mean, besides the growing scarcity of mid-range jumpers, you know, that everybody can agree is A, happening, and B, is understandable. No, I'm much more of a let a thousand different styles bloom kind of basketball observer. In that sense, Underwood is fascinating, and he's fascinating to me with my ESPN hat on, because of exactly what you named. He came in as Mr. High pressure defense. He went exactly 180 degrees from that. And again, speaking early now in Big Ten play, very, very normal opponent turnover rate for Illinois. So, in what's already a very low turnover league. So not, you don't see that every day from coaches. It's a much more common MO to say, I've been doing this since whenever, and you and possibly young people who are here now, you're going to do it this way for me again. Underwood swerved, and it makes me really interested to see what he's got in store style-wise when the post-Kofi era dawns, which surely it must at some point, because he'll have to recalibrate again. So I do look at those things. I do look at the fact that Minnesota does not get offensive rebounds. They get a special note from the basketball analytics teacher. They're not all that great on the defensive boards either. So they are definitely saying, we don't want to go after these. Don't get me wrong.
Yep.
But they're just not really equipped to be a good rebounding team anyway. So a better example of a team, you know, really consciously saying no to offensive rebounds. You might have to look elsewhere, but you know, Northwestern has turned a corner there. They're saying yes to them after many years of doing without. So
yeah.
you do look at all of those things, and that's why it's good to have the correct information at hand. And I'm saying this in a positive glass half full way, but I do still see rebound margin referenced on TV in 2022, and I do feel like that elicits a groan from knowing viewers, mm-hmm. and that is correct, because that is a completely random and empty number. Rebound margin really does not tell us much. Just look at the percentage of rebounds out of how many chances each team gets at each end of the floor.
Yeah.
And that and pace and your three-point attempt rates, those are great examples of the kind of stylistic things that very much do come into play. Well, I'm trying to figure out, hey, how good is this team really?
So if you have a team, so you know, the biggest split right now, I think, again, just going through the columns in KenPom, excuse me, is probably LSU. You know, as of today, they have the number one defense in his stat and 132 on offense. So say you haven't watched any LSU games and you just see that, what does that tell you? You know, besides of like, they don't have very good shooters, or you know, this and that. Is it, you know, do you read any stylistic things into that? Do you just say, wow, they're, you know, really athletic and they have a really good scheme for what they do defensively, and you know, look, they just struggle to put the ball in the hoop. Do you simplify it? You know, how do you view something when you're looking through and you see a team with that big of a disparity?
Yeah, LSU is interesting because they combine some things you don't usually see in the same team. And at the start, let me put an asterisk by this and say, among other things, they've been lucky. Opponents have missed a lot of threes. Mm-hmm. And if they play enough games, that will start to even out. But usually a team like LSU that is as great as they are on the interior on defense does not also force a lot of turnovers. They're good at both. And then to extend this example all the way back to your original point, which was, you know, they're also, oh, by the way, terrible at offense. Usually a team that can force a lot of misses in the paint and force a lot of turnovers, that usually comes with a certain, you know, athletic level. That means, boy, these guys are probably dunking on the other end and getting all these live ball turnovers. For whatever reason, not the case. Just a terrible, as you said, just a terrible results inside the arc for LSU. If I may, another interesting, dramatic split from the complete opposite direction would be Miami, where they are fantastic at offense and awful at defense. And this one, conversely, is a little easier to understand. They're probably about 20th at Ken's place. I kind of feel like his laptop is rushing to catch up with the Hurricanes have been doing lately in ACC play. But they are just a really old, in a good way, to be old in college is good. These are like 23-year-old guys. Mm-hmm. Really old, really savvy, really short guys who mm-hmm. can't defend and can't rebound. But they just took it to Duke, you know, in yeah. Durham and mm-hmm. beat them. These are some savvy 23-year-old guys.
They would not want kill to run into it on the YMCA. Yes,
they will just, yep. they, you know, you'll look at them, you know, you've got the next game, you look at them and think, well, you know, we're bigger, more athletic than they are.
Yeah.
They will run you ragged. So be aware of Miami if they come your way in the tournament.
Yeah. I want to get your thoughts on Purdue as well, because they have a pretty crazy split. Again, going by KenPom, they're 1 on offense, 67 on defense, which, you know, doesn't make that much sense to me, just with, you know, what they're good at and that they have the two big men and that they do have some decent athletic guards. You know, even they can put in a guy like Newman and, you know, to take care of some athleticism problems of who they're guarding and such. So what do you see from Purdue that's a struggle on defense?
Great question, because I've been looking at that, kind of rubbing my eyes, probably since December, just visually. You know, you look at Purdue, especially when Edie's on the floor, and you think, oh my God, how's that poor other team ever going to score? And as you say, I mean, they're okay. You know, they're better than the Big Ten average, but you would just think they would just be dominant. Yep. And they're not. Opponents are actually above average in making their twos. Again, speaking of Big Ten play here. And opponents, this is less of a surprise, never turn the ball over. So, I mean, that's kind of it. You know, their offense is so great because they, A, they've got Jaden Ivey. B, Trevion Williams is amazing passer, and C, they like to surround, whether it's Williams or when he's on the floor, Edie, they like to surround those guys with players who can make threes, and those same players are not always, you know, lockdown defenders on the other end. So that's kind of the deal. But I must say, you know, Ivy, I feel like his best games are ahead of us in the waning moments and in both overtimes of the Illinois game. I was often looking at Purdue offensive possessions where Ivy was being guarded by Curbelo and just thinking, ooh, this is not going to go well for Illinois. And then at next game at Indiana, he got into a little altercation with about 6 minutes left in the first half, and Painter benched him with two fouls, partly, I think, to keep him out of foul trouble, partly to teach a lesson. And that was just crucial. That was insane because he went off for 19 points in the second half alone in a losing effort. He is a dynamic special player in a year of many of them in the Big Ten, but Ivy is really good. And it's a big reason why the Boilermaker offense is so excellent.
So when you look across the Big Ten, you know, maybe give me a team that you think, you know, you just mentioned the thing about, you know, Ken Pom's laptop maybe hasn't caught up to some things with this. And, you know, the numbers, you know, visually you're going to catch on to it and like, well, we're going to watch that. You know, they really figured something out with this. And, you know, they're going to really improve over this next few. What do you see in the Big Ten that would kind of follow that? Is it what Wisconsin's done with Davis? Is it, you know, what do you see when you're looking at the full conference?
Well, this I don't get a positional advantage over Ken on this one because his laptop has been bullish on these guys all year and has had everybody saying you're crazy. But watch out for Michigan. They look like they're waking up. They haven't played many games for COVID reasons, but the ones they have, their offense has been great. Their shooting has been excellent, particularly these past two games. My gosh, they played Illinois even for the first 35 minutes in Champaign without Hunter Dickinson. So that was kind of a teachable moment for my eyes. And they look like their freshmen might be figuring it out. They're highly rated freshmen, and this could be a different Michigan team we see going forward. One that still, as we record this, at least nobody is talking about still.
Interesting. Yeah, I thought the same thing. Like maybe the most impressed I've been with an opponent this year is those first 30 minutes against Michigan, where, you know, they're without their big guy, but, you know, some of the just, you know, let's go intangibles here. Like, you know, even Howard's son is getting some of these rebound, you know, 1-on-4 rebounds. And, you know, they were really, really frustrating Illinois with defense and, you know, really, really getting after it. So I was impressed, and, you know, it does worry you that, you know, if, I thought Diabate was really, really good for stretches in that game. Maybe it's up to Houston to figure it out. But but yeah, that was, you know, from sitting there courtside, you know, eyeball test, Michigan is probably the closest to like, oh, interesting. Like, wait, this is, you know, I don't want to go there in February because that's
exactly
going to be really, really tough. Probably the most impressive I've seen, though, was Arizona. And you know, I don't know if we could just put it to Tommy Lloyd or what, but that team impressed me so much. You know, the, like, I always say his name wrong. Benedict Mathurin. However, you're supposed to say his name. Like, he was probably, he was easily the most impressive single player I've seen this season. He was so good in that game. So it's just always interesting for me to see a team that, you know, going into the season, I didn't think Arizona would be much. You know, new coach and new schemes and new, you know, they overhauled and they had all the stuff, but they have been really, really impressive. But what do you think of Arizona?
The crazy thing about Arizona is, and you know, that was a huge game that was on national TV, I do believe, and a lot of people saw it. Seemed like a big deal at the time. That was the last, you know, Illinois was the last quality opponent that Arizona has played.
Right.
Here's a little tip. They've improved since they beat Illinois in Champaign. What happens when you don't, when you play a bunch of opponents who may not make the NCAA tournament as Arizona has,
right,
then everybody, even longtime fans, even analysts, everybody, their inclination is to say, so what, you know? Well, you shouldn't do that because,
right,
you know,
right,
it gets to a point where, like, if you're beating these teams so mercilessly and so consistently, it really does mean something. And Arizona is at that point. They're outscoring the Pac-12 by about as much as Gonzaga is outscoring the West Coast Conference. It's just, you're exactly right. On paper, before the season, this was a bubble team, and this is not a bubble team.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, breaking any news. They're number two at KenPom, so it's just that people aren't believing Ken's laptop, and they're going to start playing quality opponents, and we will find out one way or the other. But that is just a crazy good team with a lot of ways to score.
Yeah. So if you you know, if you had to, you know, I know some people don't like to go on the record, but if you had to pick maybe, you know, two teams that you think you would see in the final, would Arizona be one of them? Are you, do you like Gonzaga? Are you thinking that, you know, Auburn is legit? We can get into Bruce Pearl if we have to, but, you know, what, you know, overall, who are you leaning toward right now?
Yeah, that was such a great spectating opportunity missed last weekend when Kentucky had not one but two valuable guards go down in that game. Fortunately, the second one, Wheeler, got back up and played after missing 5 minutes. But Ty Washington was out for good, and that was going to be a great game. Obviously, you know, Auburn is a deserving number one team in the AP poll with what they've been able to do, and they very well could be there at the end. I do like Gonzaga a lot, again, as everybody did last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm ready to like Arizona. I will be fortified in that when they start colliding with the likes of UCLA and USC, possibly Oregon, who's looking much better lately in Pac-12 play. I do want to see that, but I fully expect them to live up to their incredible numbers that they've been compiling so far. And to throw some big names, Big Ten names in the hat, I mean, you do have to like Purdue. You do have to like the combination they have of paint and perimeter. It was good enough in Champaign, barely, and I think they're going to be awfully tough in March.
Okay, so maybe let's go the other way. You know, you mentioned Michigan as a lookout. They might be starting to wake up and put it together. Does any other teams stick out to you nationally? If we were doing this, you know, if we were doing this last year, Illinois started 9-5 and had those bad losses at home to Maryland and Ohio State, and, you know, was really struggling to figure it out, and then click and they win 50 in the next 16 or whatever. Do you see anybody like that here mid to late January of, hey, these are teams to keep an eye on?
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like, for instance, Kentucky is a little under discussed because of a relatively large number in the loss column. You know, they've got four. You know, Alabama has five or six, I think. You know, they beat Gonzaga. That's going to show pretty well. you know, they are the team that, that plays the scheme that you're supposed to, that everybody says is the future. You know, they really, really keep mid-range jumpers to a bare minimum. So if you like that, the Tide is your team. So those would be the kinds of teams that I'll be keeping my eye on as we go forward. But again, this is the last moment I feel like where we can legitimately say it's early, and I can get away with that. But it is kind of early, and we're going to see some hard truths revealed here very soon. And hey, the NCAA will reveal a preliminary top 16, and before you know it, we'll be rolling on down the home stretch.
Okay, so we brought this all around so we can talk about Illinois. So let's talk through Illinois. And I guess I think the first obvious question is, how do you evaluate a team that just has this many? You know, Trent was out for that game. Grandison missed that game with the flu. They didn't have, you know, just looking at the games played stat, I believe it's only Plummer, Hawkins, and Williams who have played every game. I think everybody else at least has missed one. You know, Kofi's only played 14 games. Corbello has only played 6 games. Trent missed 2 games with that injury, so he's only played 16. Grandison missed that one game, you know, that type of thing. How much do we lean into what we've learned versus, hey, they just are going to have to get their main 7 out there together so we know this team?
Yeah, they do need to get everybody on the floor. That would be a net benefit. I've got 2 thoughts in that direction. One is that even though they didn't have everybody, Illinois still had a very good stretch of games straddling the Arizona loss, which, you know, as a fan, displeased me greatly. But as an analyst, or even with some distance from the Arizona game, made me think, okay, that was a good performance against a really good team. I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. And then on either side of that, you've just got wins, you know, up until this last stretch here. So that's a good thing. And again, they didn't have everybody specifically. They didn't have Andre for that entire time. So, I mean, after the, you know, absolute debacles against, you know, different types of debacles, but debacles nonetheless. A nail biter debacle against Marquette, and then just a complete and utter collapse against Cincinnati. Yep. You know, things smooth out, and so we can be that good without everybody. And there's a lot of discussion saying without, you know, Curbelo, Illinois doesn't have a true point guard, and you know, maybe that's correct, whatever a true point guard is. But the two qualifications I would file alongside that are, A, you know, who was Baylor's true point guard last year? They had a swarm of guys who could pass, shoot, and defend, and that was a pretty good way to play, and they just beat the tar out of Gonzaga, who had you know, the prototypical true point guard. And then B, you know, the things that Illinois was doing well without the true point guard, they were keeping, you know, the Marquette game didn't lead me to ever believe this would happen, but eventually Illinois was minimizing turnovers, you know, not Wisconsin crazy low, but just low enough. And they were recording a healthy number of assists, and, you know, it doesn't particularly matter if you're getting assists if Kobe is, you know, just getting an offensive rebound and slamming it home. That's fine, too. But some people like to track, you know, assists per made field goal, and Illinois is doing fine on that. So I think we get wound up on, oh, you know, until, you know, Andre, and I mean nationally, I was seeing this from analysts.
Sure.
Until we get Curbelo and Coburn on the floor together, blah, blah, blah. Illinois was belying that, and they were doing well before that ever happened. Now I'm going to turn around 180 degrees and say, but they do need Kofi, because everything they do offensively and defensively is predicated on Kofi Coburn. You know, defensively, it can be deceiving to the eyes and deceiving to the numbers. He's not a shot blocker. He's not a shot blocker this year, at least. It doesn't matter. He's a really large guy in the paint, and he allows our other defenders not to have to help, basically, especially on pick and rolls, and that is really valuable. So he is a, you know, this is not a news flash. He is a big part of this team on both offense and defense, and we do need him fit and on the floor to know what we can see with this team going forward. But the ceiling, I have to say, is pretty high based on that stretch of games on either side of the Arizona loss.
Yep. So what if, I don't know, you know, say he's out for 2 weeks, like what would you do? You know, it's obvious that you know, Bosman's Verdonk and Payne are not going to replace him, and teams are going to just sag. They're just not going to pay attention. Like, look, there's no post threat. We don't have to worry about it. Now spacing's gone. We're just going to take everything away. Their shooters aren't going to get shots. We have nothing to worry about. You know, if he is out for an extended period of time, would you, I don't know, you know, try to go to the Coleman Hawkins route of have an athletic guy at the five? I mean, what's the answer there if this did extend, you know, say the length of the Curbelo out?
Yeah, I mean, having praised Brad Underwood for his ability to swerve, he might have to do that, give a different look, try and go small, do some five out. That wouldn't be the craziest thing that we've seen come down the pike in the Underwood era by any means. And I'm sure, you know, again, as a bouquet that I can rightly toss at him, having watched him, I'm sure he would do that in an experimental fashion and see, well, let's see if this works. So it could happen. So in the spirit of your question, if Coburn were to miss 2 weeks, you know, you are talking about a team that lost a no Kofi team that lost by 16 at Maryland. So the smart bottom line would be, you know, kiss a potential Big Ten title goodbye. That's not happening. You know, them's the breaks. Yep. The good news is, you know, get him back after 2 weeks. And again, I am bullish on this team. I am bullish on a team that can play that stretch of games roughly from Thanksgiving to mid-January and, you know, pile up whatever that record, you know, would have been, 11-1 roughly. You know, that it'll mean the seed is a bit lower than it otherwise would have been come tournament time. But hey, we lost in the round of 32 as a one seed, so we know it ain't everything, and we can be a very dangerous team to play if, as you say, we've got everybody available and at top speed. Because at their best this year, Illinois has been a really good combination of generating a lot of shots, and Plummer has been a wonderful addition this year. And we've got multiple shooters on the floor, you know, surrounding Kofi, great offensive rebounding. We are really tough to play when we're at our best. So long-term, can't wait to see this team with all of its weapons whenever that does come to pass.
Okay, I got one final question for you, and it's an important one. What can be done about the long national nightmare of Wisconsin's free throw defense and people always missing free throws against Wisconsin that they'd otherwise make? Is it ever going to end? I guess it kind of has, I guess, from the heydays. But I know it's one of your favorite topics. Let's talk Wisconsin free throws and why they've been such a statistical anomaly.
Well, they've totally lost their magic because the last opponent, which happens to have been Michigan State, they shot like almost 80% at the line. So, you know, I hope Greg Gard went into a tirade in the locker
room. Yes, yes.
Afterwards, and you guys run laps. You don't care enough. You know.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the guys shooting secret lasers from the upper deck.
Exactly.
To distract. No, it has to be that, because
it's one of those situations where you literally, you know, like you're typing something into Twitter and my timeline moved and somebody's saying, well, why isn't Wisconsin better in these predictive metrics? And you know, you have to stop yourself from, you know, typing, you know, good free throw defense, you know,
right.
is not recognized as legitimate by laptops, you know. So
yes, it's not sustainable. Yes.
But no, they're in a slump now suddenly. So
all statistics eventually even back out, right? So this is what Wisconsin's going to come to Champaign in 2 weeks, and
that is true. I just get a kick out of people saying that, like when it's the Elite Eight, you know?
Right? Good point. Like, yes,
this team can win the national championship like in 80 more minutes. You know, there's not a lot of runway left for this stat to correct. So, just so you know, but yeah, Wisconsin's free throw defense might be correcting soon.
Okay, good. I appreciate you doing this. Thanks for chatting. I'm excited to see, you know, I think the Illini fan base is maybe coalescing around this idea of, okay, last year run through everything, no issues, and then an out of nowhere. This year, let's do the opposite. Okay, fine. We got a 7 seed,
exactly.
But then, you know, everybody's healthy and, you know, just start rolling through people. For me personally, I just want to be on the bottom side of the bracket. I'm so sick of 1-4-5. I'm so tired of it. Our last 3 seed or 2 seed was 1988. You know, we just have lived on that upper half, and I'd like to see what it's like to play a 6-11, to play a 7-10 game. I don't care. A 2-3 would be fantastic. You know, see what a 15 seed feels like, see what a 14 seed is like. But, you know, that's my goal for this season, somehow get on the bottom half.
Our last seed on that side of the bracket was 1980. You know, you say you're football first, but you do drop a basketball. Yes. Now, that's impressive.
Now, that's only a 2 or 3 seed for that. We were a 6 in 94? Okay. No, 93. When did we play Long Beach State and then lost to Billy McCaffrey Vanderbilt? That was 93. So we were a 6 seed then, and then I think we were an 11 when we lost to Shea Seals in Tulsa. And then I think we were even there on another time. But as far as those upper tiers, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 seeds, we have, you know, from 2000 to 2006, we just simply lived up there at either a 1, a 4, or a 5.
This could be the year.
I am ready to explore those 6-11 games and see what it feels like.
We'll do it.
All right.
We'll do it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you doing this. Thanks for hanging out, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks.
Take care.